Welcome to the SDF conferencing system.
There are two other parties in this conference.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And thank you, Publius, for that wonderful intro. Oh, wait, that's me. So what do I have to talk about today? Well, first I thought I'd let you in on a little space news. Two things that go quite well together, in my opinion. Firstly, the Boeing CST-100, also known as the Starliner, their entry for the Commercial Crew Program, right? NASA selected two contractors for commercial crew services. One was SpaceX, and their Dragon vehicle has been operating, carrying human beings, for a little bit now, right? Yeah, the Boeing CST-100 has yet to have its first unmanned test flight. The schedule for that keeps slipping. So, good on them. They, you know, so we are supposed to have two strings to this bow, but it's a real good thing, too. And Blue Origin is now suing the federal government because they selected SpaceX to award a contract for a manned lunar lander, and Blue Origin is not trying to get that selection and contract reversed. They're saying that NASA needs to be awarding a second one also to them. And obviously, SpaceX has some demonstrated competency in this area, but again, it's not bad to have two strings to your bow. Of course, this assumes that the idea for a manned lunar landing in the next couple of years doesn't just get canned the way it has repeatedly. Let's see. It's worth noting, many people in what you might call the new space community have referred to Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin as dino space, with the idea that these are big, clumsy organizations which are going to be made extinct by the small, agile, nimble ones. The other thing is they have a tendency to refer to SpaceX as Dino Space 2.0, that they're just doing the same things as the others, but they're doing them better. In other words, better processes, more willingness to take risks, more build, test, build new, test new, rather than what Boeing has been doing, for example, with the CST-100, and what has become the standard thing in the space business since the end of the Apollo era, which is calculate, simulate, calculate, simulate, calculate, simulate. You may never actually build a final article, but if you do, it has to be exactly right the first time. So they refer to SpaceX as Dino Space 2.0, but they seem to have forgotten the one advantage that comes with doing things that everybody already knows can be done, which is that the cost of actually getting to the point of being able to do them doesn't include nearly so much research and development. And I know you're going to say, well, what about that business of landing stuff on platforms out in the ocean and all this? Well, look, when I say things everybody knew could be done, I'm including that. There was no ambiguity. Lockheed Martin and Boeing, which are the two partners in United Launch Alliance, which have the Delta and Atlas families of rockets, they knew it could be done. Their engineers would tell you it could be done. But their business department said it wasn't worth risking their own money on developing that capability. Where was the market for it? Very short-sighted, in my opinion, but that's where we are. Now, other thoughts. I've got a lot of thoughts to share, of course, and sometimes they don't always come out in any particular order, but for those of you who may be wondering, oh, nuclear energy, that's your solution to everything, isn't it? The answer is no, absolutely not. Nuclear energy is not my solution to every problem. I'll give you a great example. There are enormous wildfires burning now in the American West and even larger ones in the Russian Far East. Am I advocating for putting them out with thermonuclear explosives? I am not. You could, in fact, extinguish them with thermonuclear explosives, but it wouldn't do you the slightest bit of good because, yeah, you'd put them out, but you wouldn't be able to cool the embers at all. And so after the blast wave had flattened everything and snuffed out the fire, within a few hours it would be burning again. So don't do that. There's no point in it. Similarly, I'm not arguing for building nuclear-powered airliners to reduce the carbon footprint of global air travel. It can be done. You know, there's no doubt that it can be done. In the late 1950s, General Electric built the HTRE-3, which was judged to be adequate as a nuclear-heated gas turbine engine for aircraft propulsion. Wouldn't have been especially economical, but there was a plan to build an airplane that would have used this reactor. Now, of course, you talk about this reactor, and anybody today would be absolutely horrified, because we're talking about a system in which air is drawn in by the jet engine in the usual way, compressed in the compressor, then, instead of being sent through a combustion chamber, is sent into the core of a nuclear reactor when it's, you know, operating at high power and high temperature, and then it flows out, expands through the turbine, and returns to the atmosphere again. It worked. In ground tests, they did all kinds of things with it to simulate what you'd have to do in the air, and you know, the power-to-weight ratio, they were confident they could achieve an acceptable power-to-weight ratio, acceptable fuel element life, and so on, but man, oh man. The French actually got to the point of considering building a nuclear-powered airliner. That one of the early proposals for what was called the Super Caravelle, which later became the Concorde, was for a nuclear-powered airliner. The thing is, nuclear power that we know how to build for aircraft. Now, even if you get away from the open cycle, blow atmospheric air through the core of an operating nuclear reactor type of design, because Pratt & Whitney did have what was called a closed cycle design, even though they never got far enough in tests to operate it as a jet engine. The idea with that one was you have a reactor over here, it's got either molten salt or maybe molten lithium, high temperature metal, something of that kind is circulating in the reactor as coolant. You pump that out into a heat exchanger in the engine. And so the air is compressed, passes over the heat exchanger, then out through the turbine, and so there's no need for the rather unpleasant business of just ducting large amounts of atmospheric air right through the core of your multi-hundred megawatt reactor. I can understand why people wouldn't be enthusiastic about that. Anyway, but the open cycle reactor had a relatively poor power-to-rate ratio. The closed cycle reactor probably would have had an even worse one, at least the first few generations. Of course, you develop it and you could get better over time, but. And the thing is, it's also very, very expensive. And so you want your aircraft to be very fast so it can make the largest number of trips in the shortest possible time, supersonic ideally. But that conflicts with, you know, that requires a very high power to rate ratio. So it's kind of difficult. And then you have to remember that the handling facilities are also very complicated. You couldn't use your ordinary airport. Matter of fact, the United States Air Force built a thing to serve as a terminal for nuclear-powered bombers. It's up in Idaho. Never built the airstrip for it, but they built the hangar. And it looks more like a submarine base than your usual aircraft hangar, because in order to get an acceptable power-to-weight ratio, it was necessary to use a technique known as shadow shielding or divided shielding, in which there's a certain amount of radiation shielding around the reactor itself, along with padding to protect it in case of crashes and all that kind of thing. But there's also then the remainder of the shielding is just around the pilot's compartment, because then you're farther away from the reactor, inverse square law is working in your favor, and so on. So you only shield the parts of, you know, you only shield things that are actually sensitive to radiation. You shield them in proportion as they are sensitive. And of course, this strategy meant that they had to develop everything from control cables to hydraulic fluids that were less sensitive to radiation. But again, the result was that in order to, when you landed the airplane, it was necessary to essentially stick the very nose of the airplane through a big hole in a concrete wall so that the pilot's cabin was and their door was ahead of a big radiation shield, and then they'd roll a radiation shielded van out to basically airlock with the door on the pilot's cabin, and the pilots would get out and they'd be driven away, and then all the servicing was supposed to be done by this giant all hydraulic remote manipulator system that looked kind of like Gundam and never worked very well at all. But obviously for an airliner, your problems would be multiplied because you don't just have to shield the pilots, you also have to shield the passengers. And the Super Caravelle nuclear design, among other ways it accomplished that, was by making the fuselage quite long and having just a large empty space between the reactor compartment of the tail and the passenger compartment. The reactor being very heavy, the balance of the aircraft was not adversely affected by this. But anyway, there'd be a large 10, 20 meters of dead space, and then the second radiation shield, and then the passenger compartment. Anyway, the result of all this is that the airplane would be very, very expensive. Whether you could actually make it work supersonically, you'd need a rather higher power-to-rate ratio than was ever achieved in tests. So you'd need a lot more development funding for that, even if it, you know, presumably can ultimately be done. And then you'd have these very, very expensive handling facilities. So a given continent would probably only have one or two airports. You know, in North America, for example, you might have one in the New York area and one in the Los Angeles area, and that would be it. Maybe there would be a third one in the Toronto area, which would also handle Chicago traffic. But that would be it, because just the handling facilities would be very expensive. These would be very, very large airplanes, twice or three times the capacity of an A380, probably, just to be economical at all. You'd have very few flights per day. And what are you actually trying to do here? If you're trying to decarbonize your economy, well, less than 5% of all global fossil fuel use is accounted for by air travel. More than 50% is accounted for by electric generation. So where should you go first? Again, the good folks at Nuclearia, the German pro-nuclear group, the one German pro-nuclear group, and they're more anti-nuclearism than anything else, you know, but the good folks at Nuclearia have calculated that two very radical steps, which people are talking about in Germany, they feel they're very radical anyway, imposing a 130 kilometer per hour speed limit on the Autobahn, which has people's hackles up, and at the same time, banning domestic air flights. Either of these two measures would save about 2 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions a year, which maybe sounds like a lot. I don't know. Keeping the six remaining nuclear power stations in Germany running and closing the equivalent power of coal-fired power stations would save 70 million tons a year. I know. I'm appealing to numbers. I'm appealing to quantitative reasoning rather than to feelings, and some people just can't forgive that. But if you want to achieve a goal, you have to look at what means are more or less capable of getting you to that goal. If your goal is decarbonization, you should be focused on the big users of fossil fuels, which are essentially electric generation, home heating, heating and cooling, buildings, homes, business premises, and so on, and transportation. And in the field of transportation, it's very definitely you start with ground transportation and short distance ground transportation in particular. You know, I've been harping on this theme of grid is good. What do I really mean? Well, the question is, what scale are you operating at? What makes sense for the scale you are operating at, right? Automobile transport is a blessing for people in rural areas. Not so much for people in urban areas, where it rapidly turns into traffic jams. It's the same way that if you're in a rural area, well water, getting your water from a well, is a fine idea. If you're in an urban area, that doesn't make nearly so much sense. Again, discharging your waste to a septic system works great in a rural area, not so well in an urban area. Much of the world's population is urban or urbanizing, in part because it's cheaper to supply basic services the higher the population density is. And this has consequences. You know, I was a while back dealing with a construction contractor. I went out to a work site of his, and he was saying the people who owned the place, they had a problem because their well kept clogging up with sand. And he was saying he was trying to get them to connect to the municipal water system, and they wouldn't do it. The problem being, the well was over 200 meters deep. I was on the site. It was less than 200 meters from their house to the road where the water main was, and it was all over land they owned. Now, it's got to be cheaper to dig a shallow horizontal trench than to drill a well, especially once you've had the well fill up with sand and have to be cleaned out a few times. So I am big on grid is good. Something I've been decrying, pastoralism. You may not actually know what I mean by pastoralism, so I figured I ought to talk about it a little bit. You know, at least since classical antiquity, poets have been putting their verses into the mouths of shepherds. Now, this may have something to do with what anthropologists surmise, that the Indo-European family of languages originally developed among herding, semi-nomadic herding peoples north of the Caucasus. But on the other hand, it may not, since the Hebrew Psalms are put into the mouth of David. They're attributed to David, who was supposed to be both shepherd and king. So who knows? But yes, poets have had a tendency to romanticize, idyllicize the life of the animal herder. And by the late 18th century, the mania, the pastoral mania, had reached such a fever pitch that Marie Antoinette and her ladies of the court were playing at being shepherdesses and dairymaids, you know, in a manner which didn't involve contact with actual shit, blood, and so on, which you wind up in contact with a lot if you do any actual animal herding. People who had lived, had any experience of life outside the perfumed gardens of the aristocracy, were very angry about this. They felt that all the hardships of their real lives were being mocked by these aristocratic twits who never had to get their hands dirty, but who were play-acting at it. And that was one of the things that drove the French Revolution, one of the things which drove the mass guillotinings of the upper class, was this resentment that was generated by play-acting pastoralism. So when I see people in wealthy countries basically saying, oh, well, the simple life is better, people in rural Zambia who don't have laundry machines and don't have dishwashers, don't have much in the way of lighting and so on, they're better off that way. They don't have the stresses and strains of people in the modern world. I think you're setting yourself up for the guillotine. A great example of this, I think, would be the delightfully unself-aware people at Low Tech Magazine, who talk about their solar-powered web server, that they've got, I don't know, a Raspberry Pi and a big battery bank and some solar panels, and they say, you know, you may have to wait for our page to load because it's solar-powered, ha ha ha, aren't we being so nice? And, you know, they actually ran an article a while back saying, you know, it takes more energy to manufacture the memory chip in your typical laptop than the memory chip will actually use over the course of its average life. You know, assuming that you use it for 3 years and then discard it, which apparently a lot of people do. Not me, but that's, you know, another story. Well, probably not a lot of people listening to this, since people on SDF, I think, have a tendency to keep hold of computers rather longer. But it shows their total lack of self-awareness, because if it takes that much energy to manufacture the memory chips, what about a solar panel, which is made of the same material but requires hundreds of times more? Think about that for a minute. Don't let it bother you too much, right? Because, you know, I hear from people who say, well, the point of change is not that we should use better energy sources, it is we should use much less. Generally speaking, you get a person, I mean, this happened to me the other day. I was on SDF Mastodon, and I was being wry about the fact that a letter I'd mailed had arrived 6 weeks later in Germany, and I said, you know, that 40-knot nuclear-powered ocean liners could deliver the mail around the world in a week, and I guess airplanes are supposed to do it even faster than that, but we don't seem to be doing a very good job. I probably should have added to my list intercontinental mail rockets, which could deliver the mail anywhere in the world in 45 minutes. But somebody, of course, the anti-nuclear true believer, and it really is a belief system, never loses a chance to put his oar in. And so some random person responded, oh, but you're poisoning the world with the horrible nuclear waste, and so on. And I said, that's really a misconception. And it has a purpose. It's a misconception with a purpose. The fact is that when we began to use nuclear energy for civil purposes on a large scale, we already had a high confidence in a strategy for managing the radioactive wastes, the nuclear fuel wastes. You reprocess and vitrify the fission products that the experiments at Chalk River with vitrification had already shown by the late 1950s, early 1960s, that this was a workable path. Anyway, and that the fact is that this claim exists for one purpose, which is to distract people from the millions upon millions of tons every day of fossil fuel wastes, which are being dumped directly into the environment because we have no idea what else to do with them, right? People say something about nuclear waste to avoid talking about fossil fuel wastes. That's the only purpose of it. You know, and then a person will come back to me and say, oh, but I wasn't talking about fossil fuels. I said, well, of course you weren't talking about fossil fuels. Germans are particularly bad about this. Very sanctimonious people, Germans, talking about how, well, they're shutting down their nuclear power plants, and that way they're going to save the world from radiation. Uh-huh. And they're just panting to get connected, the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, because their economy isn't going to run without the kind of energy that either fossil fuels or nuclear can provide, and that wind and solar can't. How do I know this? Because their emissions have not decreased at all in 30 years, despite all the money that's been sunk into wind and solar developments there. That's official figures, which are, if anything, probably optimistic. The German emissions have not decreased in 30 years, period. End of sentence. Full stop. And, you know, that's the thing, is that anybody who says, well, the point of real change is to use much less. Who is going to use less? How are they going to use less? I'll tell you this right now. If we were to equalize all the people of the world using the same amount of energy per head of population as the European Union average, and the European Union average includes some relatively poor countries like Bulgaria, you'd still have to double the world's primary energy output. That means really sharp cuts in countries like the United States, and you'd still have to double the world's primary energy output. Things like solar panels, things like single-board computers. You think, oh, well, this is the energy-saving option. Well, honestly, you still have to make them in a very high-energy society. Silicon Valley, California in the 1970s, that was an area which was probably using on average twice as much energy per head of population as the U.S. national average. Shenzhen, China today is using 3 to 5 times the amount of energy as the Chinese national average. You know, people in rural China are living a standard of living which is comparable to Zambia or something. People in urban China are using a lot more energy. And they can't increase the energy supply very much. They're digging out coal as fast as they can. They're bringing in tanker loads of black oil from Indonesia to burn in their power plants in the coastal cities. And so they have to use military force to keep the people in the countryside in the countryside. Keep them to stay there. Because those folks want that higher standard of living. That's just how it is. So saying we've got to use less, you're not coping with the realities of the world situation as it is today. And furthermore, you want to talk about billions of people. You know, there are billions of people who are drinking untreated river water. As I say, the more energy you consume, the less your ecological footprint has to be. This is what I'm talking about. Major cities, San Diego, California is a great example. Decades ago, in the 1970s, San Diego, California had a sewage treatment plant, the effluent of which was potable water. The city supervisor in San Diego actually kept in a little refrigerator in his office. I was a water district supervisor. Anyway, this was a story Jerry Pournelle told, I think, in one of the original A Step Farther Out articles. Had a tray of ice cubes. If you accepted an offer of a drink, he'd put the ice cubes in the drink, pour the whiskey or whatever over it, hand it to you, and after you were halfway through it, would tell you, oh, by the way, the ice cubes in the glass are made from reclaimed sewage water. Think about that for a minute, right? That is much lower environmental footprint. If you can recycle your water, you're not taking as much water from the rivers. You're not doing what New York City does, diverting immense quantities of water from upstate New York. You're not doing what Los Angeles does, diverting immense quantities of water from arid areas that really can't afford to lose it, right? You can have sewage retreatment systems. You can have, for your coastwise cities, seawater desalting systems. You can reduce that environmental footprint as long as your energy source has a small enough environmental footprint. And this is what I keep going back to. Everything you can do has a cost. Everything you can do has a disadvantage. Everything you can do has a downside. When we weigh up, when we total up all of the disadvantages, the raw materials that have to be mined, the fuel, the wastes, this, that, and the other thing, we eventually have to come to the conclusion, if any of us is honest with ourselves, that nuclear energy is probably the least environmentally damaging option, the option with the smallest footprint. That's what matters here, because if wind machines and solar, if they were free, if the raw materials were free, you'd still have to pave over a lot of ground, you'd still have to cut down a lot of forests and drain a lot of swamps, which is what has been done in places such as Germany and Scotland. Swamps have been drained, forests have been cut down. This is a real thing, all right? To make way for wind machines, solar panels, and so on. The cost is high. The advantage that nuclear energy has essentially composes two things. Firstly, the difference between the amount of fossil fuel that has to be consumed to produce a given amount of energy and the amount of nuclear fuel that has to be consumed to produce the same amount of energy is roughly 1,000,000 to 1. And secondly, this is important, the difference between the detectable level of a radioactive substance and the level required to cause harm is typically also about 1,000,000 to 1. And I tell you more about that, except that the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe is starting in less than 10 seconds.
7.